Welcome to the Void Time Podcast. I'm your host, Emilio Estevez, back at it again with a new episode of the Void Time Podcast. As always, I'm joined by Babby. Just no intro. It's an interesting take, I suppose. Maybe he's frozen or something, but it's fine. Yeah, this week we have a slam dunk episode, as always. We are talking about some movies and a television program. I think in terms of, like, new stuff, not much. Smiling Friends did get a trailer, but I didn't watch it because it's coming out in a month, and I'm already going to watch it. So, no use in doing a trailer, really. Although I have seen, you know, it's a good sign that they appear to be hiring as many YouTube animators as possible on this season, which is cool. I like that, as opposed to Invincible, which we're going to be talking about, which is almost entirely celebrity voice casts. I think it's nice to have a bunch of internet creators on a show. So, looking good, season two. People are hyped. I'm hyped. I'm sure it's going to be great. But I did briefly want to talk about Invincible season two, just because it's done now, and I have seen it. The like four episodes that came out the past month or so. Invincible, I kind of binged it like a couple months ago. And then I realized that the other half of season two wasn't out yet. And then they just released it. And so I thought, well, hey, I could talk about it a little bit since I talked about the show when I finished it. What do I think about the last couple episodes? And they were pretty good. I don't know. I feel like Invincible is a pretty solid show. It's not one that's like super heady. Like The Boys or something. Not that The Boys is super heady, but it's like more like a social commentary thing. Invincible doesn't really have that. It's just a pretty solid show. A solid superhero show, I guess. I think the thing to note about the finale and the thing that everybody's talking about is that somehow they snuck in Spider-Man, Batman, and Fortnite in the finale. Which I think is pretty neat, I guess. Batman and Fortnite were more direct. Spider-Man, they had to do a workaround where basically the last fight of the season is Mark, aka Invincible, and he's fighting this guy that can teleport to different dimensions. And so I will say, I don't really like how the fight is staged, and maybe this is how it happens in the comic and they're just adapting it directly, but it's like the guy who can warp to different dimensions is like holding Mark's mom and brother hostage and like torturing them while he's being warped to different dimensions. And it's like, and then while he's in the other dimensions, he's just like kind of chilling and talking to people, and I'm like, shouldn't you be like trying to find a way out? Like, why are you just chilling and talking to Batman? Although legally they couldn't say it was Batman. It's just a guy who's on a city rooftop at night with a black cape. I have been seeing that some people hope that that's Man. The meme from the Arkham subreddit, which is probably one of the most off-the-rails subreddits of all time. It started off as, like, legit discussion about the Arkham games, and now it's just, like, the biggest Batman, well, really just not even Batman, just, like, shitpost subreddit. And they just started this meme where they cut off Batman's ears, and it's just Man. And that's just been going around. Okay, just got a message from Babby that he is dying. Not literally, but he'll be back shortly. So it's just me, which is fine. But yeah, I do like to imagine that in this world where Mark is like, so you're dressed up as a bat and you're a man. I like to imagine that it's actually just man who doesn't have the bat ears, which would be pretty cool. A pretty nice nod. But the Spider-Man one is like more direct. Like there, it's just like a guy named Agent Spider, and he's voiced by the guy who played Spider-Man in the Spectacular Spider-Man show. And he's fighting a guy with octopus arms, and it's just like so blatantly Spider-Man. And like the fact that they got the Spectacular Spider-Man guy is just awesome. It's like so direct. But it's like, oh, he's Agent Spider. It doesn't count. He has like a black and yellow suit. And it's like black, and it still has like the web designs on the arms that Spider-Man has on like his whole suit. It's so weird. I can't believe they got away with it. But I did see something that like the creators were like, yeah, we didn't reach out to Marvel or DC. I think they found out when the episode premiered. So I guess hopefully they don't get sued, although they would be suing Amazon, so I doubt they would do that anyways. But I don't know, still a pretty good show. I feel like it's kind of hard to talk about just because there's not a whole lot of like meat to it. It's just a really solid superhero show, for adults. Welcome back. Babby's here. Yeah, of course, everything died as soon as we started the episode.
It's not the first time it's happened.
No, it's not. I was just talking about Invincible Season 2 and all of the cameos that were in the finale. I'm sure you've seen them. Everybody's been talking about it.
Possibly.
With Batman and Spider-Man.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, just blatantly being in it. But yeah, that's pretty much it for Invincible. Pretty good show. Yeah, pretty good. I would recommend it. If you're kind of tired of the whole superhero thing, maybe the Marvel thing, the formula, how all of those movies have been the same since Endgame, then, but you still like superhero movies in general, or superhero-related content, I guess, then check out Invincible. But I would say check out The Boys first. The Boys is better, and it has way more meat to it. It's tackling bigger issues, and it's actually a pretty smart show, in my humble opinion, which is always a plus. But Invincible is by no means like a baby kids show. It's just, you know, no social commentary really, other than like genocide is bad, which, you know, is a message that most people can get on board with, I think. Anyways, we're going to talk about films, hit films. Actually, none of these are hit films, except for the last one. Yeah, I decided to, this was just kind of a spur of the moment thing where I just got a notification that Repo Man, the hit 80s cult movie, was added to Netflix. I'm like, oh, I've always wanted to watch Repo Man. I've heard great things. It's in the Criterion Collection. I've heard that it's a really wacky movie. And I was like, oh, that sounds like a good time. I'll check it out. So I put it on the TV, and then Netflix, for some reason, didn't have English subtitles, just Spanish subtitles. So I'm like, oh, well, I can't watch it on the TV then, because I won't be able to understand anything. So then I had to watch it on my phone with earbuds, because that's the only way that this deaf boy would be able to hear and understand what was going on. Although, to be frank, I still don't really know what was going on, and I feel like I understood most of the dialogue. I am convinced that this movie may have had some production stuff going behind the scenes where there was like 10 minutes just disappeared. I'm not sure if that's true, but right before, like in between act two and three, there's like just a jump, and then like people say stuff as if we're supposed to know, where it's like there's this girl who Emilio Estevez hooks up with once, and then she's like in one other scene with him, and then at the very end she's like, what about our relationship? Like, you don't have a relationship. You hooked up in the back of his car once, and then he came over to your place of work and started stripping and say, hey, let's have sex at your workplace. And then she's like, no. And then now she's like, we're in a relationship? There was just a lot of stuff missing. And I don't know if there was just missing footage. Maybe they ran out of money. They couldn't shoot anymore. I don't know, but there's a lot of holes in the movie. And I don't mean like plot holes. It's just like holes as in like stuff like that, where it's just like there's jumps. And then like people will like make declarations about like relationships or events that we haven't seen that weren't in the movie. And I was just very confused. And you know, this movie is already kind of confusing just based on the plot, because the whole plot of this movie is it's about this little guy. I don't know why I said little guy. Well, I guess he's a high schooler or 16 or 17. He's a little guy played by Emilio Estevez, who we'll talk about later. And he gets a job as a repo man after Harry Dean Stanton, which I was very excited to see Harry Dean Stanton in this after watching Paris, Texas and David Lynch movies. It's like, oh boy, 80s Harry Dean Stanton. This is going to be a treat. And, you know, he like kind of recruits Emilio Estevez to be a repo man. And then there's like an hour-ish, maybe 40 minutes because it's really short. 40 minutes of just like repo man stuff. And he's like, you know, he's stealing cars and, getting money, and he's living the life, and he has this chick that he banged once. And then there's a B plot where the chick he's banging is working for a nonprofit that is going to expose the fact that the government has alien bodies that they're experimenting on. And basically throughout the entirety of this movie, everybody's chasing this car because this is like beige. I don't even know what kind of car. I don't remember. There's just this beige car that has four alien bodies in the trunk, and they're like really hot. And I don't mean like sexy. I mean like temperature wise, they're very hot. We actually never see the aliens. And so everybody in the car, like they'll start driving it, and I was like, oh, it's too hot in here. I need to step outside. And then someone steals it. It's like this big, like, I don't know, like Looney Tunes kind of cartoon where everybody's like stealing the car, where it's kind of like the end to like Emperor's New Groove or something, where it's like this, you know, you could plot this on a map and it would be like the map scene in Emperor's New Groove where you're just like tracking everybody and one person has a car and another person has the car. And then a bunch of no good thieves have the car. But then this crazy guy gets the car, and it's just this big thing. And then we're cutting in between car hijinks and Emilio Estevez stealing other cars, but not the car, just different cars. It gets very confusing. It's a very confusing movie, in my humble opinion. And then the movie just kind of ends. The car, they spray some like glow-in-the-dark paint on the car, and then the car starts flying with Emilio Estevez and the crazy guy in it. No, Emilio Estevez and like the engineer for the Repo Man. And then they fly off into the sunset and it ends. Assumedly, the car explodes and then everybody dies. That's the only assumption I can make. Or maybe it goes to the mothership. Although, I think the aliens are dead or not. Maybe not. Otherwise, I don't know how the car starts flying. Yeah, I don't know. I was very confused by this movie. Maybe another watch would help with that. But honestly, it wasn't that entertaining to justify another watch. Acting performances are all over the place. I mean, you have Harry Dean Stanton and Emilio Estevez, who are like pretty solid. Harry Dean Stanton is very good in general, but I thought that his performance here was fine. And then like other performances range from like okay to like terrible. And so it's kind of hard to watch in that way where like nobody's believable. Which I don't know. I don't know why I don't like this movie very much, because this is totally something that we would watch on like a bad movie night. It's like a 80s B movie cult, you know, that type of movie, like Hack-A-Lantern or something. And I love Hack-A-Lantern, but for some reason I just did not like the Repo Man. So sorry. I won't be purchasing the Criterion edition of this movie. I don't know why it's in the Criterion collection, but also House is in the Criterion collection, and that doesn't seem like a Criterion movie either, even though that movie's great. Very funny. And so after that, I was like, wouldn't it be funny to watch another movie where there's barely any aliens in it, but the plot revolves almost entirely about there being aliens? And so I decided to watch the hit 2021 film, The Vast of Night. This movie is really good. It takes place in the 50s in a small town in New Mexico, so you already know there's going to be a UFO. It's right around where Roswell is and like Area 51, so you know there's aliens afoot. But it follows our two main characters. One is a dude, and he's a radio host. He's like a fast talking, wisecracking type of 50s guy. Guys who say, like, I don't even know, they speak in like riddles. You know what I'm talking about. Those 50s type guys. And then there's a girl who's like 15 or 16, and she's a switchboard operator. So it's these two kind of professions that you don't see very much these days. And they are like, basically, there's a UFO over town. And we're getting it from the perspective of these two characters that are in very kind of technical, they're dealing a lot with like equipment. You know, the switchboard operator is like, you know, they have to plug in all these cables to connect all these phone calls to whoever they're calling. And on some of the lines, there's like this weird kind of static. And so then she sends it over to her radio friend. And then the radio guy, like, puts it on the radio broadcast, like, hey, is anyone else getting this? Because apparently it's messing with our broadcast. And so it's this kind of interesting, kind of like a Ville Newsome, you know, where it's very in the nitty-gritty, all in the, like, technical details. You can tell that, like, the actors definitely, like, spent time preparing and, like, learning how to use this equipment. Because, you know, nobody works at switchboard nobody is a switchboard operator. I don't even know if operators are even a thing anymore. Except for, like, calling 911 or something. That's, like, different. But in, like, that kind of environment just doesn't exist anymore. So it's really cool to see it. And there's a lot of like just really long one shots where like, we're just seeing her like mess around with the switchboard and like try trying to figure out where this noise is coming from and calling people to be like, hey, can you check in on this person? They're supposed to be watching my sister. And it's just like, I want to say it's maybe like a 3 to 4 minute long shot of her just like doing this technical stuff and talking to people, which might sound boring to some people, but man, was it not like the most interesting thing for me. I love that kind of stuff, all in the details, especially like this old antiquated technology. It's just like, it feels so analog, so real, where like you watch a movie that like, you know, comes out these days, which I mean, this movie came out like a couple years ago, but you know, like you see, I've seen clips from like the Godzilla movies, not the minus one, but like the new ones where King Kong is riding on Godzilla's back or whatever. And they are all just like whipping around like computers and touch screens and like holograms. That's in like the Marvel stuff too. And it just feels so fake and so lifeless. And it's like, it's like unrelatable. And it's like, okay, I get it's just for plot convenience. Super, well, they're super rich and they are so good at technology that they have innovated and made these things super cool. And it's like, I would much rather watch 5 minutes of the radio guy like setting up his broadcast and setting up his like reel-to-reel recorders to try to figure out how to put it on his show. And it's that's the stuff I really like. And I think this movie does it very well. You can tell, I think it is an Amazon original, but I think it's like they didn't get a very big budget for this. And it's, I don't know, there's only like a handful of characters. But like the plot of it and like why there's like nobody there is that like the big, the high school is having like a big basketball game and it's between the like rival town. And so because it's a small town in the middle of nowhere in New Mexico, everybody in town is over at this basketball game, except for like a few people that are, you know, a few older people that are just listening to the radio and calling in. And there's just a lot of, you know, like older people, like just giving long monologue stories, really long shots. I can't, I mean, I feel like that's pretty much all there is to say. It's just a really well done sci-fi movie that you can tell, like, pretty much it took no money to make. And it's like one of the most engrossing and interesting movies I've seen in a very long time. So yeah, I just want to shout out The Vast of Night. I'm a couple years late. I think it came out in 2021. But yeah, just a really well done, a really well shot movie too. I mean, I know I keep saying that a lot of long shots, but there is like a lot of really impressive shots when they're like at the high school with the basketball team and like before they're setting up and like during the game. Like these really long shots where you can tell like everything is like choreographed down to like a T, like in the Goodfellas one shot or whatever. It feels like it's crazy that they were able to do this. Yeah, I don't know who made it, but it's clearly a bunch of talented people. So watch The Vast of Night. It's great. But it's not like gonna be, don't expect like an Independence Day or anything. Like it is very stripped back. No lasers. No, you don't even see the aliens. There's just a UFO. So, and spoilers. It's like barely in the movie. There's like a couple shots of it and the movie ends. So don't go expecting a special effects extravaganza. Just it's a very small indie film. And it's very good. Although I don't know if you can call a movie that's an Amazon original an indie film, but it has that vibe. So yeah, check it out. It's very, very good. And so I was going to watch another Alien movie, but I didn't So instead, we're going to be talking about The Public. I watched this one with my mother because she's going to school to be a librarian right now. And this was homework. And she was like, "You like watching movies? Do you want to watch my homework with me?" And I said, "Sure." So we watched The Public, a film written, directed, produced, and starring Emilio Estevez from Repo Man, except now an older man. This movie came out like a couple years ago, kind of like The Vast of Night. And this movie, it's a social commentary on homelessness, mainly. But it follows Emilio Estevez, and he's like a supervisor at, I think, like the Central Library in Cincinnati. So just really insert big town here. And it's like a cold snap moves in, and basically like there's homeless people dying because it's so cold outside and shelters are full at capacity and like there's no emergency shelters. And so like the crux of the movie is that basically around like 50 homeless people kind of organize like a shut-in at the library and are like, "Hey, we're going to stay here after you close because it's too cold outside. And if we go outside, we'll probably die because there's nowhere else to go." And so Emilio Estevez he's kind of this like moderator. It's kind of in between, although he ultimately ends up siding with the homeless people because he doesn't want them to die. And so then we're introduced, and let me just say, it's a star-studded cast. I'm pretty sure like Emilio Estevez just knew these people and was like, "Hey, do you want to be in my movie?" Because Christian Slater plays the sniveling little weasel of a corrupt politician who just, "Hey, send those homeless people on the street. Hey, I'm an evil guy. I don't care about homeless people. I'm running for the mayor, and I'm going to have the best campaign." And then Alec Baldwin plays a detective, and he's like, "I also want to get rid of these homeless people." And then Michael K. Williams from The Wire, who's fantastic in The Wire, is like the main homeless guy that kind of organized this show and is kind of the leader between them. And so it's this conflict where, like, they're negotiating with each other, and outside the news is they're twisting all of the facts, and, like, stuff is coming out about Emilio Estevez where, oh, it turns out he was homeless at one point, and he was a drug addict at one point, and now he's turned his life around and is a supervisor at the library, but the media's like, he's a evil guy. He's probably relapsed and is crazy and is going to kill a bunch of these homeless people. And then on the inside, Emilio Estevez is like, "Hey, please don't shoot. We're all peaceful. Let them just stay here tonight. And maybe like for a week until this cold snap, you know, dies down. And then we can resume normal library operations." And so that's the crux of it. There's a lot going on. And frankly, if I'm being honest, too much is going on, because you have this really interesting premise with this homeless shut-in and the library workers kind of being on the side of the homeless people, and meanwhile the police and the politicians are like, "Hey, get them out." And so that could have been its own thing, and it would have been pretty good. But Christian Slater is like, "Eh." They're doing too much with, like, you can tell they're doing, like, a, "Ooh, politicians are evil and corrupt." And, of course, you hire Christian Slater because he's, like, you know, he's, like, the evilest guy. He has, like, the evilest face in existence, I guess you could say. And he's just, like, this sniveling little weasel of a man. And it's, like, we spend a lot of time in the beginning, like, establishing that he's running for mayor and is, like, his campaign isn't doing well. And there's like this pastor guy who's like really popular in the polls. He's kind of like, he's just an all around good guy. He's running for mayor because he genuinely wants to help out. And he's doing a lot of stuff to help homelessness in his city. And, okay, I don't know how much Emilio Estevez has written, or if this is, like, his first foray into it. But, I mean, screenwriting 101, if you... you shouldn't have the bad guy on the back foot in the beginning. The evil, corrupt guy should be the guy who's leading in the polls. And because he's evil and selfish and greedy and willing to lie and cheat his way up to the top, you start him on top. Because what you're doing, what you're doing by having him start off on the lower foot and having the actual good guy trying to help his community already basically going to win, is you are showing the power of corruption and, hey, this is actually a viable strategy to achieve power, which, I mean, it is. But, I mean, that's not what we're like. I don't think that was the message that he was trying to say, was that turns out when you lie and steal and cheat, you win. And, like, that it's a good thing. I don't think that's what he was doing, but that's kind of how the movie ends up telling that story, because he twists the story of the homeless situation in the library to where, oh, he is actually an evil guy and he's holding these hostages and he's probably going to kill them. And it's like, we need to send the SWAT team in to tear gas a bunch of unarmed homeless people. And then, like, the media backs him, and it's just, like, I don't know. We never see, like, the outcome of the election, and I'm sure the good guy would have won in this universe. But, yeah, I don't know. Because there's also a thing at the end where the good guy who's running for mayor is also organizing this, like, drive for people to come in and donate, like, clothes and non-perishable foods for the homeless people in the library. So that would have been a really great thing for, like, if Christian Slater's on top, he's leading the polls by, like, 10 to 15 points, and because he's sending in the SWAT team to, like, remove the homeless people, and meanwhile the other guy is, like, organizing this drive to help out the homeless people and have that, you know, be the message where it's like, hey, if you do good things, then, you know, the media will cover that, and then you'll be successful in life. Be a good person. Don't be an evil, corrupt man. And so, yeah, it's a little bit shaky. I think Emilio Estevez had a lot of things he wanted to say, a lot of social issues that he wanted to tackle. I'm not even going to get into the fake news stuff because it's so heavy-handed and, like, stereotypical that it's basically what you're expecting, where it's like, I am a journalist, and, ooh, if I say the stuff that is more clicky and evil and, like, try to twist this guy to be a big villain, then that's going to get me more clicks and more viewers on my local news station at 2 a.m. because I guess everybody's at home watching the local news at 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. towards the end. It's just like, okay, we get it. We get it. The media does this. They sensationalize everything. They twist everything to make stuff sound way worse than it actually is. We get it. And I don't think that angle was especially needed, because it takes up a decent amount of runtime, and it's like, focus on the homeless people, focus on the struggle between the police and the politicians against the just public workers and the homeless people that are just trying to survive. That's a movie, and it would be a pretty good one, but it's just like, just a couple things. It's like so frustrating, because there's, like, a shell of a great idea here that is just not executed all that well. And so, yeah, it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate because, you know, it has a great cast. Everybody is, like, giving it their all. You know, Michael K. Williams in it. I mean, I gave it half a star extra on Letterboxd just because he's in it, because I love him so much. And so, yeah, it's just, it's kind of disappointing. But I think I've said all I need to say about The Public. Check it out if you want to. I don't know. It's not, like, needed, but I would say check out The Festive Night first, and then The Public, and then Repo Man. In that order, that's kind of where I put them. So that's that. I do want to briefly talk about Vertigo, which I know seems random, and it kind of is. But one of the theaters in my town, it did a little throwback screening for Vertigo, and I saw it a couple years ago, and I remember basically nothing about it, except I'm like, I don't really remember liking it that much. I mean, it was fine, but like, I'm gonna give it another shot. So I went to the movie theater, and I gotta say, shout out local small art house theaters. It was like a really small theater, maybe like 20 people tops, probably closer to 15, just in this small little screening room watching Vertigo. And I will say, maybe one of the best shot movies of all time. It's very, very pretty. It has that Technicolor, very vivid, you know, bright colors that everybody loves. But the story kind of sucks. Or it falls apart, I'll say that. And I don't want to spoil Vertigo too much, because I do think that it is one of those that's still in, like, the public sphere of, like, ones that people do need to see. Because it is, it's shot great. And there's a lot of, like, interesting things that Hitchcock is doing with the cinematography here. But man, it gets downright uncomfortable at the end. And maybe it just didn't age well. I would say that maybe. Because, I mean, it came out in the early 60s, I think. Maybe 50s. You know, obviously a very different time. But yeah, let's just say Jimmy Stewart. I love Jimmy Stewart. He's a great actor. But a little bit of a manipulator, a little bit of emotional abuser. I don't know how much else I want to say. A little bit physically abusive at the end. And that whole time I was just cringing. And I could feel it. It was a very small, intimate experience that I was having with everybody there. And like, it was dead quiet, like, for the last half of the movie, when Jimmy Stewart's attitude, like, completely changes, and he turns into, like, this weird, creepy guy. Like, everybody, like, there was, like, gasps, and, like, people were, like, whispering to each other. It was kind of shocking. And, yeah, I was just especially shocked because, like, this movie is still talked about a lot as being, like, one of the best movies of all time. Which, I mean, Gone with the Wind is too, but, like, this one even more. I don't think anyone's really saying Gone with the Wind is the best movie of all time. But this one is. It won the Sight and Sound 2012 Best Movie of All Time, dethroned Citizen Kane for, like, the first time in 50 years in that publication's existence. So, like, that was recent. I guess recent in the grand scheme of things, 10 years ago. And, yeah, I don't know. I don't really like it. It makes me very uncomfortable, which is unfortunate, because the first half is, like, great. It's like a noir mystery. And then it turns into something worse. I don't know. So, yeah, I mean, it's definitely, like, my least favorite Hitchcock. I haven't seen a whole lot, but Rear Window and Psycho, I would considered like pinnacles of those genres. And so like, yeah, this one just like falls flat and is rough. It's rough. Honestly, okay, here's what I would recommend. If you're going to watch Vertigo, and I'm being 100% serious, you should watch the first half, and then there's this weird psychedelic dream sequence that's like part animated and like just a bunch of weird special effects. Just stop watching after that. It's all downhill from there. If you're anything like me, you'll be intensely uncomfortable throughout the rest of the movie after that. And honestly, all of the technical aspects that are really well done in the first half kind of go away in the second half. It's just worse. I have no idea why people put the like rank this so high, because it falls off so hard. So, yeah. Before I completely lose all of my credibility as a movie critic, that's all I'll say about Vertigo. But yeah, watch it. Watch the first half. But that's it. And that's pretty close to being everything for me this week. I have been playing the original Resident Evil 4. And I will probably talk about it more next week when I finish it. But I'll just say it holds up. It holds up really well. I didn't really expect to be scared by, you know, a really old game. At least 20 years, maybe more. Probably more. And there was still moments where I was like, oh, shit. I was running away. It's still really scary, especially like after like the third chapter. I think there's 5 chapters, but like once you start being in the spooky castle, which I guess, is that a spoiler? I didn't know. I don't know. But there's a spooky castle, and that's where I am right now. And it's very scary. Because you're not fighting, like, zombie people. You're fighting, like, weirdo cultists that are, like, chanting things the entire time. And they're chasing you. And the whole time they're chanting weirdo stuff. And they're all in their black robes. And sometimes if you shoot one of their heads, then a giant bug thing comes out. And it's so scary. Yeah, it's rough. But I want to play the new one. So I was like, well, I should probably play the original. And so I've been playing it on my PS2, and it's a blast, I guess. But that's it for me. I'm going to throw it on over to Babby for his segment of the show.
Whoa. Okay. We got stuff to talk about.
Oh, boy.
This might be a random order, so we're just gonna jump around all over the place. All
right.
But a decent amount happened this week. I guess we'll start with some albums. Why not?
Okay.
Actually, we do have a couple singles. I know there's a new Cavalier single. Didn't listen to it. I'm waiting for the album because that'll be in next Friday, actually. So I'm waiting for the album for that one. Damn. We also got 2 new Charlie singles. Ooh. Also waiting for the album on that because I feel like she's very gung-ho with these singles. But I mean, the first single was pretty good. I'm sure the other two are great as well. Spotify has a preview album feature now, which is really neat.
I like it.
So I can actually see the release date and all the songs, which is great. So that's gonna be coming out on June 7th. Very excited. Definitely seems more dance kind of club focused, which I'm definitely into. So I'm excited for that. Just got a new Kamasi Washington single. Ooh. From the new record. This one's got Andre 3000 on it.
Yo,
it's great. Dream state. It is not rapping Andre, it is flute Andre. And I think it works really well. You get this fantastic saxophone and then you get the funky flute from Andre, and it works really well together. and it's a great track. So excited for this record, big time. I might do a dive into the epic eventually one of these weeks when I'm feeling adventurous, I'll say. It's a long record. I love long records, but that thing is long.
Yeah, I saw Heaven and Earth vinyl the other day, and it was like $100.
Yeah. Mossy Washington Records are the kind of records where you go in the record store and behind the checkout counter where they have like all the Beatles collector's editions, they have Kamasi Washington sitting there with like the 6 LP or whatever these records come out to. So I might dive into it eventually. It sounds very good though, from a couple of tracks I've heard from him, and this new track is pretty good. I think we got a new Knocked Loose single. I think that came out this week. Late last week. Oh, it came out Wednesday, so we got podcast timing. But Don't Reach For Me from the new record coming out May 10th, I think. Knocked Loose is one where I listened to their 2016 record a couple months ago. Wasn't into it. I felt the vocals were too insane for me. Dude was barking and doing a whole bunch of crap. It was kind of niche and weird. But I feel like the vocals on this new record are pretty good. They sound like it hurts him physically to do that tone, but I think it works pretty well. I'm not really into metalcore or anything either, but I don't know. The way they're doing it here, the energy here is great. So looking forward to that record. Should be pretty good. I think it's like less than 30 minutes, so it should just be like a quick in and out, like adrenaline fest. So definitely excited for that. Other singles, I think that's pretty much it for singles this week. I'm sure I'm missing some stuff, but okay, we can jump to albums, I think. And then we'll do albums and we'll do news after. There's stuff happening. We will start with this new Richie album. I did not know this was coming out. Apparently there were singles for it and everything, and I just completely missed it. But to be fair, I don't think I was like looking for the name. So this was a nice surprise. This is Richie from Injury Reserve, or By Storm now, with a solo record, Triple Digits. It is about as weird as you'd expect it to be. He's definitely kind of taking the style from the last Injury Reserve record and kind of spinning it a little bit for his solo work. I think it's a pretty decent record. I don't know if it works as well as By the Time I Get to Phoenix. I mean, it definitely doesn't work as well, but I think part of that is like it is so fractured. It sounds like you kind of mixed that Injury Reserve record with like something that Mike would do, and it creates a it's a fun listen, but it's like incredibly quirked up and it doesn't really have a lot of structure, and it goes in 17 different directions. And a lot of these songs don't even read as songs. They read as more of like abstract movements with a couple of like bangers sprinkled in. So it's a cool record. I feel like it doesn't have a lot of staying power for me so far. It might change on a couple future listens just because it is so out there. But I do appreciate that he's going this route with his music, because I do think By the Time I Get to Phoenix is one of those like groundbreaking records that kind of sparks a lot of inspiration for people around in that same genre, which we've kind of been seeing already. I know Peggy does a lot of the glitch stuff, but I think that record takes it a step beyond what Peggy does. So excited to see what they do with By Storm. I thought they were going to do a record this year. I'm not sure if that's still happening, but still definitely want to check out if you're in the abstract kind of glitchy hip hop area. I think Dizzy with Amine is probably the best track here. Amine kills everything, and he just brings a great attitude to every track. So, check that out. Next, we got Mount Kimby, artist I have not listened to before, but saw it come up on the new releases, and I saw post-punk, slacker rock, and kraut rock as the genres, and I'm like, I will definitely give this a try. It's the Sunset Violent. It's pretty good. It's very slowcore-ish and kind of understated, so I definitely need to listen to it more, because it is so. I was listening to like a lot of like high intensity like in-your-face music. When I listened to this album and switching this was, like, so much of a change of pace where I was, like, not paying attention fully. So I do need to revisit this. But off first listen, there's definitely a lot of great tracks here. Definitely sticks in that duster, slowed down, lo-fi-ish rock area. We got two King Cruel features on here, which definitely makes sense. I mean, this could be a King Cruel record on those songs specifically, but those ones are probably my favorite, Boxing and Empty and Silent, especially Empty and Silent. The closer on this album is great. But yeah, it's a very kind of subtle, nice, chill rock experience. Definitely going to go back and give it a little bit more attention whenever I have the time, just because I feel like there's a lot more this record can give me. I just haven't had the mood where I want something chill like that. But definitely don't skip that one. Okay, what do we got next? I think those were the two albums besides one, but we're saving that one for later. Because we'll have the most to say about it. Let's do some news stuff, because things are happening. A lot of things are happening. Billie Eilish, new record coming next month. Yeah, May 17th. No singles, no nothing. She's just dropping it. I'm very excited. It is Hit Me Hard and Soft. It's got 10 tracks. It's going to be, I think, pretty short and sweet. Yeah, I'm very excited for this. I think Billie has pretty much knocked it out of the park with almost all her releases, I would say. I mean, even her Don't Smile at Me EP is pretty good. But I think When We Fall Asleep, obviously, one of the best pop records of the last couple of years. I guess that was 2019 already, 5 years ago. But that record's great. I love it. Happier Than Ever has grown on me quite a bit since it came out. I love that kind of switch to more singer-songwriter focused, playing a lot with like bossa nova and some like ambient pop stuff. I think that album has aged really, really, really good. So very excited to see what this new record is. I think she talked about wanting to blend genres a little bit more on here. So we'll see what genres she's feeling. I don't know. I don't even know where I want her to go. But I feel like I have enough trust. I don't like Finneas as a producer with everybody, like anybody else, but with Billie, I feel like he does a pretty good job. So I'm not really worried about any crazy genre shifts. I think they'll pull it off pretty well. But yeah, definitely excited for this. I like how like the only promo for this record was just like her getting in the news for saying that Taylor Swift shouldn't make 27 variants of every single record she puts out.
Which is true.
Which, respect, it is very true.
Yeah.
So I'm there for it. Yeah, very excited for this. I'm sure our friend Grant is very excited as well.
I'm sure.
Yeah, that's coming out in the next month. We also got the No Worries, Anderson .Paak and Knowledge, their collab kind of group. Finally have a release date. We have a track list. So Why Loud is the title. It's out June 14th. I think June 7th for physical editions and June 14th for streaming for some reason. And the track list is stacked. We got Thundercat, we got her, we got Snoop Dogg, we got Earl Sweatshirt, we got Charlie Wilson, and we got Dave Chappelle.
Dave Chappelle?
So, yes. Dave Chappelle's on the first track.
Oh.
Which Why? I'm not a fan of. but I'm glad it's right at the beginning so we can get it over with right away.
That's true.
Dave Chappelle has been on a lot of records, so...
Yeah,
can't what's say up I'm with surprised. That? I don't know why people keep putting him on records, though. All he does is talk, and it doesn't really add anything of value. And personally, I don't really have anything that I want to hear from Dave Chappelle anymore. So
yeah, not right now.
I'm kind of good. But it's on the first track. I would be really stupid to dismiss the rest of this record because of that.
Oh, sure.
This might be reaction worthy. I think this is going to be a really fantastic album.
I'd be down.
Yeah, 19 tracks. I think it's going to be a slapper. But
that's a lot of tracks.
Definitely excited for that. I think I've heard the original No Worries record, but it's been a long time. So I might brush up on that a little bit more. It's definitely a little bit more hip-hop focused than like typical Anderson .Paak's solo work.
Like soul stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean it's a nice blend. So but Knowledge is a really great producer, so I am sure this is gonna be great. They also released one or two singles this week from this record. But I think I'm just gonna hold. Just gonna wait for the whole record. I've been listening to a lot of singles this year, and I'm like trying to hold back a little bit. But yeah, that will be coming, and I am very excited. We also got the Lizzie McAlpine record this week. We'll be doing that on the channel.
Sure will. So I've heard good things.
I've been hearing some, good things about it. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited.
Me too.
I don't know if there was anything else besides our main event, kind of.
Oh boy.
Jermaine Cole.
Oh, yeah.
Let's talk about Jermaine Cole.
All right. Yeah.
I haven't talked about J. Cole in a long time. So I feel like we're due. Okay. He dropped a surprise mixtape this week. Might delete later. Not a great title. Yeah. I guess I can talk about my feelings about J. Cole before we get into this. Sure. I've been a J. Cole fan for a very long time. I would say at least a good 7 or 8 years. He was one of the first rappers that kind of got me into the genre and like kind of helped me explore. I think I went to J. Cole, and then J. Cole was a bridge to Kendrick for me. When Damn came out, I was all over that, but I didn't like look into Kendrick's discography too much at that point. But I've always thought he's been pretty good. Listening back to a lot of his records, I don't feel that way too much anymore in the past couple of years. I don't know. He has like I don't want to say a Logic effect because it's much less of an extent, but he definitely, I don't know. There's a certain energy where it's like, it's good, but there's nothing to stand out about it.
He's a little corny.
Yes. I like 2014 Forest Hills Drive, obviously. I think that record is great. And For Your Eyes Only, I think, is my personal favorite of his, even when there are some questionable songs on that one as well. But, I mean, I've always enjoyed him. I still love his features. I think he's a really fantastic feature artist. He carries a great, great presence to, like, any track he features on. And I think that Revenge of the Dreamers 3 compilation from, I think it was 2021 or 2019... It was 2019. Oh, my God. Time is flying. I think he did fantastic on that record. I think being amongst, like, so many peers, you can tell why he's kind of like a top dog in that respect, because he was doing fantastic on that record. I even thought the offseason was pretty decent. I definitely think that was a little bit of a return to a form after the nothingness that was KOD. But all this brings it to Might Delete Later. Surprise mixtape. This is obviously sparked by the Kendrick Lamar track on the new Future record, where he called out J. Cole and Drake. Mm-hmm. More so Drake, heavily on the Drake side, but J. Cole was definitely part of that conversation.
Yeah.
So we don't get a diss track, we get a full mixtape. With a diss track on the end of it. So we got 12 tracks here. It's 43 minutes. I gave this thing a 50 because it is so middle of the road and mediocre that it's hard to really talk about. I don't know. I feel like giving something a 50 is like, yeah, it's not the worst thing I've heard, but it's also like, I listened to it and I went back. What I got from it was pretty much nothing. I think this is like his most unfocused, his most... I don't know, generic. The beats weren't doing much for me. The features were okay. But he wasn't really saying anything great. Like, I don't know. It felt like this thing was made in a couple of weeks, and I think it probably was. I don't think he had this thing just sitting and waiting. I feel like he had some loosies that didn't really fit anywhere, and he was kind of like, all right, I'll tack this onto this project. He's also one of those guys that has like this like roadmap for his career where he's like, I'm gonna drop The Fall Off and that's gonna be my last album, and that's all you hear about constantly.
Like Tarantino.
It's like, okay, Yeah, exactly. And now you get this where it's like, all right, what is this? I think calling your mixtape Might Delete Later is very questionable to begin with. That already does not inspire confidence.
No.
But you get your typical kind of like trap Southern hip hop instrumentals here. I think Alchemist is on one of these tracks. I don't remember Sticks and Stones. That was the only ones I gave a heart, actually. Wow, my subconscious just knew. It's very generic. There's not much to be said on there. It's typical, you know, braggadocio. But I don't know. There's not a lot of substance. I was really digging Pi with Absol until J. Cole said, like, one of the worst lines I've ever heard from him. Very weird, like, transphobic bar on that track. And I'm like, why did you put that on here? Really weird. Especially since Absol killed that song. I'm like, I really enjoy this and the beat's great. And then J. Cole just comes out of nowhere with that. I'm like, what are you doing? So that bar's awful. There's also one where he does like the alphabet and like doesn't say L because he doesn't take L's. It was really bad. This thing felt like it was rushed. I mean, I don't think Cole's the best like lyrical rapper in the world. I definitely think he's more similar to someone like Drake than he is Kendrick. He makes good pop rap. Or at least he did a while ago. I feel like recently he's been kind of coasting a little bit. I think his feature runs are always good. I think people hype up that Johnny P. Caddy's verse on Benny's record way too much. Cause I think Benny did better than him on it. but I don't know. There's this weird aura around J. Cole for a long time. But then we get to the 7-minute drill, which is the like official kind of diss track, I guess. Which did not go over well. It's not great. It's really strange when you compare like That and 7-Minute Drill. Like That being, I would say, a bait song, trying to get them to respond, which I guess was successful for one of the people so far. But it was fun. The beat was bouncy. Kendrick's energy was fun. It was a little bit goofy. But then we have 7-Minute Drill, which has kind of this cliche, like, sinister piano. You have a conductor beat, which I don't think works as well here for what he's trying to do. And J. Cole's energy on the track is not even that great. I feel like if you're going to be coming at someone, you should not be like this laid back. It didn't seem very, he didn't seem confident going into it at all. And it just read as awkward. The main points I think he was making was that, I guess I should say, for this diss track, he borrowed a lot from Jay-Z during the Jay-Z and Nas beef.
Mm.
There's 3 or 4 lines that are like homages to one of the Jay-Z songs from that beef. And he kind of flipped it to use it against Kendrick, which is fine. You can do that. I mean, I think comparing Jay-Z to Nas and like you two going at it, like that's fine. I think that's fine. But like, those comparisons don't work when it's you versus Kendrick, though, because he was talking about how, like, his output has only been, like, 6 records in 12 years or something, but J. Cole only has, like, 7 records in 12 years. He talked about how Good Kid, Mad City was great, but T-Pab put people to sleep, and then Damn was his peak, and then Morale was tragic.
Uh-huh.
But he also got the album listing wrong because Section 80 was his first album and not Good Kid, Mad City. So if you're calling Good Kid, Mad City sleepy, then that's even worse of a fate.
Oh, that's true.
Butterfly, I think. Which then sparked people on Twitter, like, trying to spin the narrative that T-Pab was boring and not great. And all of them failed miserably.
Yeah, I don't
like,
know.
There were people posting snippets of the record and, like, some of the best parts being like, y'all really like this? And everybody's like, yeah.
Yeah.
so that was kind of embarrassing. What else went on in this track? I don't know. It's so weird because J. Cole, for so many years, like, J. Cole was one of the, like, founders of this big three kind of talking point because he would always compare him, Drake, or Kanye, and Kendrick. He's been doing this for probably half a decade at this point. And then he's also got the, I'll bar anybody, I can do, you know, I can take the best and I can hang with the best. And that's a lot of his lyrical content for the past, I would say, 3 records, and then early in his career as well. But I mean, obviously he does not back that up. I knew he wouldn't be able to back that up. And I still like J. Cole, but it's like such a weird, I'm very disappointed, but I also knew this was the exact way that it would pan out. Yeah, the diss track was not great. It didn't really touch any points that were like good. I think the only good jab he got in there was like, if we weren't dissing, nobody would be discussing Kendrick at this moment, which is true. He's not doing anything right now.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll take that. Go for it. I mean, that's where you should hit right there. I feel like taking from a lot of Jay-Z's things at Nas, a lot of them don't apply to you. So it just comes across as like not copycatting, but like trying to fit like a square plug in a round hole. It doesn't work. And it just comes off as really weird. But then on top of that, we had the Dreamville Fest where all the Dreamville artists were doing a festival with other artists. And J. Cole performed on Sunday, I think, and then said he regretted dissing Kendrick.
Yeah.
And might delete the diss track off of streaming, which is absolutely hilarious. That was one of the funniest times I've had online in a long time. It's just very embarrassing. I think it's the discredit it does to your own discography and everything. And I understand that, like, you know, there is no real beef between Kendrick and J. Cole. No. There isn't. It's purely competitive beef. But Cole's been nagging at that and wanting that for, like, years and years and years. And then to, like, kind of drop a very, like, I don't think he went nearly as hard as he should have gone on a diss track. It felt like he was, like, trying to tiptoe and he was, like, complimenting him 1 second and not in the other second. He didn't commit. And now he's like, I shouldn't have even done it at all. It's very, it's not great.
No,
it's not great at all. It's really hilarious from Kendrick's perspective because everything Kendrick has said has been absolutely 100% true. Like going through his catalog, you look at The Heart Part 4. He's talking about Big Sean on that track, but it applies exactly.
Yeah.
And it's funny because people have been posting like all the artists that have apologized to Kendrick, and there's like five of them, including like Big Sean and J Electronica. And now it's funny to add J. Cole to that list. Like J. Cole literally beat himself in a beef against Kendrick.
Yeah, Kendrick didn't even need to do anything. He just apologized. Need to do anything.
Yeah. Bro dropped a mid diss track in a very forgettable mixtape, and then 2 days later said, actually, no, I shouldn't have done that.
A coward.
The weirdest turn of events. I think J. Cole stans are still trying to flip it on, like, why does everything have to be competitive? And it's like, this is what your guy wanted.
Yeah.
And it is the spirit of hip-hop since the very beginning that, like, it is a very competitive art form. I mean, battle rap is a whole subgenre that still is popular. And it's not like, I'm not saying, it is in J. Cole's character to do this. It is not a character for J. Cole. I could see this coming a mile away. It's just funny that it actually happened. But I think when you talk that big in your lyrics and you have this kind of presence to you where you're like, I want to take on the big dog, and then this is what you bring and then take it back, I don't think it's a great look. And I think it discredits a lot of the lyrical content that you've had on past records. I mean, if we got the J. Cole that was on 2014 Forest Hill Drive and you have like that Fire Squad, Tale of Two Cities, J. Cole, I still don't think he stands anywhere near Kendrick. Those are great songs, and I think they're fantastic, but it doesn't, there's no through line between the two. I think J. Cole and Drake are a lot more similar than J. Cole and Kendrick. Kendrick is way more lyrical than these two, and he makes music way differently than these two. I still don't think, like J. Cole is off the big three. I think his kind of legacy and his popularity and building his own label up and putting all these people on through features and stuff like that is very honorable. And I like, that's obviously still going to be part of his legacy. And that's why he is like one of the biggest hip hop artists right now still. But I don't know, there's this huge plateau that has happened. And this is a very not good look for him at all. It was really something. Kendrick, did some funny voices on a really quirked up Metro beat and just absolutely demolished J. Cole without even having to lay a finger on him. I mean, he went mostly for Drake, but used the big three thing that Cole talks about all the time to wrap him in. And then
yeah,
he just completely imploded on himself. And it's hilarious. it's sad, but not too sad. It's, I don't know, the competitive edge of it. I think everybody was having a great time because I'm like, yes, this is what we need. We need this competitive edge back in hip hop. And this time it's like beef that isn't like personal side. It's all competition worthy. We're like, this is going to be great. I am loving that we're going to hear these guys all bar out and see like who really has it. Mm-hmm. And then J. Cole just kind of flops over himself and in the weirdest turn of events. But I mean, one down, I guess, if you want to view it that way.
Yeah.
I really hope Drake does respond. I think he will. I feel like it's going to be weird if he doesn't. I do hope he does. I think Drake, like, unironically, would have a much better diss record than J. Cole would have. One, because the beef with Kendrick goes for, like, half a decade back.
That's true.
They've been in sales wars and all kinds of sub-dissing each other for years and years and years. Plus, Drake has a lot of experience doing this. Like, this is kind of what he does. He did it with Meek Mill. He did it with Pusha T. He kind of got Meek Mill. Pusha T absolutely demolished him and sent his career into a really weird trajectory and made him become a father. But, I mean, it'll be interesting. I do want to hear Drake on a diss track. I think it'll be a really fun battle between those two. I don't think Drake stands a chance at all, but I think he put on a better effort than J. Cole. But I want Drake to take the bait so we can hear a full Kendrick diss track, because I think he's just going to absolutely like blow it out of the water. Not being a Kendrick fanboy or anything, but like there is no competition. When you look at these three, there is no competition for Kendrick in these three. And I think that was his whole point of the future verse, where it's like, stop roping me in with you guys. You are like on a completely different level than I am.
Yeah.
And it's true. And we're seeing that in real time.
Not in like a good way.
No, not in a good way.
Yeah.
So I think he was just sick of it and he wanted a little bit of competition back in because it's been kind of stale lately. So yeah, really interesting stuff happening. It's really fun to watch. I feel like it's exciting to kind of like catch up with all of it and be in the middle of it again. I re-listened to Story of Adidon and I realized how insanely good of a diss track that song is. Like, that hurts. That is maybe one of the best diss tracks of all time. If you like take out the rose tinted goggles for like the 90s, I think the Story of Adidon, like Pusha T dissed Drake's entire family line, his dying friend announced that he has a child and that he's a deadbeat dad.
Yeah.
Like all of that in like 3 minutes. And the whole blackface picture that he somehow found to put as the cover art. Like that is absolutely like Drake took the bait on that so quickly and Pusha had that thing ready to go. That's in a different level than this will ever be. But I think just revisiting that Pusha T beef where it's like, oh my God, this is one of the best things that you can put for a diss record. But we'll see what happens. I do hope Drake responds. He did post like something on Instagram where it's like, whatever trophy with a notebook next to it. Very Drake like. So we'll see if something comes out of that. Cause so far all he's done is put captions on Instagram and do subtle little things at his shows, which again is Drake fashion. So I do hope he does something though. It's been like 2 or 3 weeks now. I mean,
yeah, it's been a minute.
Somebody does something. I want to hear a Kendrick diss track. I really want Drake to get decimated again by another person. But I also want Drake to compete because that's when I like Drake the most, because he can be petty, really petty, and I enjoy it.
It's been so sleepy.
Yeah, but we'll see. Just a really weird and fun time at the moment. But with that, we also have another Future and Metro Boomin record coming out. I think, is it this week? I think it's this week or next week. So this is not a deluxe. It is this week. It is not a deluxe. It is a completely new record. So excited for that. I mean, having two ready to go is pretty impressive. I'm glad that it's not just like some deluxe bait and that it's an actual new record. It would be hilarious if we had another Kendrick feature on it. That's all I'm saying. Because knowing Drake, he'd be petty and drop it the same time that the new album comes out, which I think will happen if he's going to do anything.
Yeah, true.
So, I don't know. I feel like this is a little gossip, like drama tea corner. This is funny. This is just like Gossip Girls for the boys.
That's true.
But yeah, fun stuff going on. Other than that, I don't think I've been doing too much. I've been listening to Kendrick again because I haven't been doing that in years. I'm like, man, he still holds up. I feel like my hip-hop has kind of strayed further and further into the abstract, so Kendrick kind of gets left behind a little bit, but for being that mainstream and creating this stuff is still, like, incredible. I listened to Pimp a Butterfly for the first time in, like, 3 years. I'm like, yeah, it's still that album.
It still is.
It's still that good.
Yeah.
So, if anything, I like that this beef is igniting all of their catalogs again, bringing us all back a little bit. I enjoy it. But yeah, other stuff. I'm seeing Swans next month.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
They just posted their U.S. tour dates to kind of like re-elevate it. And they added some new shows. So I'm like, all right, I'm doing it. There's not going to be many other chances. I'm going. I don't care if it's in Chicago. I'm going to somehow make it and drive through there somehow. But I'm doing that next month. I think it's like they said like 75% of it is new material, which will be cool. So very excited for that. I've been to Godspeed, so I know what music feels like physically. This is going to be even louder, and we're going to be standing and not sitting. So,
oh, boy.
We'll see. I'm going to bring my industrial-grade earplugs so I don't lose my hearing and hopefully not pass out. Yeah. yeah, I'm very excited for that. I've been missing concerts, and I'm like, all right. I'm pulling the trigger. I don't care if it's in Chicago. I'm finally just going to, like, see how hard it is to truly get into Chicago. But I got to see Mr. Michael. There's not going to be too many other chances to see Mr. Michael. Not saying he's dying tomorrow, but he is 70 and making music and touring, like, nonstop with this kind of music.
Yeah.
Because this isn't, like, an acoustic guitar sit-down-and-play show. This is a full physical and mental workout for 2 hours. So we'll see how that goes. I will report back with many things to say, I'm sure. But yeah, that was exciting. So now I have to scramble to figure that out. But I think that's it this week. Hopefully next week I have more stuff to talk about when it comes to the rap beef of the century. By that I mean, not really.
Of the kind year.
Of a. Of the year. Yeah.
Let's not go that far.
No, it's of the year. It's the only one that's happened this year, but it's the best one.
That's true.
But I think that's it. I don't think I missed anything. So
nice. Yeah, I don't think I've listened to a whole lot of new stuff. I've been going back to Nurture, getting ready for that new Porter Robinson record. That album is so good. I've pretty much come around entirely on all of the songs I was not so hot on that reaction. Mm-hmm. And now I, like, love every single song, which is nice. It's nice. I think the only one I'm still kind of iffy on is Dol Scythe, just because that one hurts my ears a little bit. but other than that, pretty g-dang great.
Real.
But, yeah, I did want to quickly say that I also listened to A Crow Looked at Me on your recommendation a couple weeks ago.
Somewhat recommendation.
Well, you said it's something that everyone should listen to.
It is, yes,
at true. Some point. And so I took your recommendation and I went on a little bit of a nature walk. It was like, you know, upper 60s. But I had this very kind of, well, sad in a different way than what was, you know, in the context of the record. But, you know, I have this spot I always go to. There's this lake and there's a bunch of, like, hills nearby. And so I have this spot I park, like, a mile away, and then I walk along the coast of the lake up into, like, this spot that's on a hill where there's a bunch of, like, trees that had fallen from the flood in like 2017. And so, like, just a bunch of, like, trees laying down, all the bark is stripped off from the water, and it was, like, perfect because they were all laying down. And so, like, there was one tree I always sat on that there was another tree right next to it that I could put my feet on. And so it was like this perfect spot for listening to music where I can just like look out at the lake, and it was very pretty. And so I was like, well, okay, that sounds like a good spot. I mean, that's my spot. I'll go there and listen to this sad record and be one with nature and with this record. And so that's what I did. And I parked my car and I started walking, and I'm like, man, this is like really sad. This is sadder than I thought it was going to be.
I wasn't lying.
You weren't lying. It was so, as you were saying, it's so intimate and so specific, which I think makes it like harder to listen to because of how specific it should be. Where you were even saying like you shouldn't even, it doesn't feel like you should be listening to this. And that's like 100% accurate. I'm like, I don't know this guy. I don't feel comfortable knowing this about another human being that I don't know personally. And so like that was going through my mind as I'm trekking to my spot. And I hadn't been there in like a year and a half. I just moved back home to Des Moines, and I was just walking there. And when I got there, the trees were gone. And there were some scorch marks, and I think there was a lightning strike that hit it, and all of those trees were disappeared. The ones that were there were all burnt and scorched and, you know, not fit to be sitting on. So I was like, I had my own little moment of like, oh, that's kind of sad. Well, now I don't have anywhere to sit. So I just had to sit on the ground and finish the record. So not quite as good as it was before, but, you know, obviously that pales in comparison to what the dude from Mount Erie was going through. But it was just like this kind of apropos moment where I'm like, oh, it's an album about loss. I went here to dedicate this thing, and now, you know, my spot is gone. I'm gonna have to find a new spot. So that was my experience. It's very good. I don't think I'm going to listen to it again anytime soon, but I'm glad I listened to it.
So. Exactly. That's the feeling I had. I'm like, I'm glad I went through it because I feel like you need to. I don't know. I've listened to it like 5 or 6 times, I think. it's so good. I have those issues with albums that are hard to listen to where it's like, if it's that good, I'm going to go back to it.
Sure.
But I don't know, I've already gotten like a deep personal connection to it just through the couple of listens. And I think the shock value of like how personal and like absolutely like heart-wrenching this record is, you kind of get an underlayer in the new listens of like just the movements of life and the stillness of things and the subtle like tiny moments in your day. Yeah. And I feel like that's been kind of poking through more through this record. So there's definitely like a huge underlying like hopeful, peaceful kind of part to this record that kind of comes with time with it, which is interesting, and I've really enjoyed. I mean, it's still deathly sad to listen to, and I can't put it on next to anybody else because I'm not gonna do that to anybody. But I it's still an like incredible record. It's like comforting in a really weird way to me now. Like the way the instrumentals on this thing are so skeletal, but they hit so hard. This is like Nick Drake level of like simplicity done at its best. But yeah, I've moved it up to 100 out of 100. I think it's perfect. I think it's one of the best albums I've heard. Just like the impact of it immediately, and then how good the lyrical content is, and how well you can latch onto it. Yeah, it's one of those special ones where it's like, ooh, I have not had an album make me feel this way in a long time. I feel like the microphones are just my thing right now because I've been listening to the Glow Part 2 a lot, and I just bumped that up from a 99 to 100 because I'm like, all right, it's finally happening. It clicked with me, I don't know, sometime within the last 3 months without me even realizing it. I'm like, oh, wait a minute, I listen to this thing like a lot now. I don't know. It's interesting. I've listened to 2 records by the Microphone/Mount Erie, same kind of thing. both are 100 out of 100. I feel like that says something, and I feel like we should do more of that eventually. I do want to do the Mount. I think the next one we'll do is probably Mount Erie by the Microphones. Their 2003 one. I think that's the one everybody recommended as well.
Yeah, I think so.
But yeah, I definitely want to do more of them because, like, I don't know. From what I've heard so far, is only perfection. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's hard. I think
it is.
I think what makes, because it's interesting that I have like this. A very different reaction to that album than I do with Carrie and Lowell.
Mm-hmm.
Just in that, I think for some reason, when Sufjan does it, it like doesn't hit as hard for me because he doesn't really get into the specifics.
No, and you can tell he's very artful still.
Yeah.
Like he is a showman at heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is true. It's just like if you read the lyrics to like, I think even like John, My Beloved, I don't even think like necessarily it's like gives off that it's like the saddest song on the record.
It's the music for me that does it with Sufjan.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas Mount Erie is kind of, it's not like it doesn't sound sad, but it's like, it's very stripped back and that it is just very intimate where it is him and like one or two other instruments going at any time.
Yeah. There's no avoiding it.
No, no. Which is, yeah, like similar to Nick Drake.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's just kind of interesting because I listen to Carrie and Lowell pretty regularly. And
yeah, and I'm the opposite. I still can't listen to that record, but I can listen to A Girl Looked at Me Now without too much issue. It's still going to put me in a mood, but it's not going to like devastate me. And I think that's just one of those like having personal connections tied to a record will forever change the way you look at a record. And I feel like Carrie and Lowell will forever just be that album where it's like, probably shouldn't do this.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that. I could see that. For me, I think the weird thing is that it's something of like a comforting record to me for me. Mm-hmm. Because like a couple years ago when I was like at my worst mentally, that was like the only album I was listening to, which probably wasn't a good idea. But now it's like, you know, it's nice. I like listening to it now because I'm like, I can listen to it now. I'm not sad anymore. Well, not that sad. So, I don't know. Yeah. I have this weird relationship.
It was a comfort record for me, too. And then I, like, had two people pass away. And then I was, like, listening to that record to help. And I was, like, helping. But now when I look back at the record, I'm like, oh, now it takes me back there. Mm-hmm. That's weird. I can't do that anymore. So, I don't know. It's interesting because Carrie and Lowell is not the saddest record of all time.
No, I mean,
I think
there's sad songs.
There is, but I think For Emma that we're gonna do on the channel soon is also kind of that level in certain ways.
Sure.
So yeah, I don't know. It's interesting.
It is interesting.
Little psychology talk at the end of the podcast here.
Yeah, a little bit of like music theory.
Yeah,
I just think it's interesting how we can have
like, it is interesting
two different relationships with two very sad albums.
Mm-hmm.
And why? I don't know why, but I don't know. I think it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, we got Lizzie McAlpine this week.
Yes.
Check that out. Then we got For Emma Forever Go, start of our Bon Iver series.
Yo.
The week after. Very excited for that.
It's going to be good.
Yes, sir. And then after that, we'll see what we're doing. I don't know if it's my turn after, since I don't know if that For Emma is my turn. I don't know.
I don't know.
I hear your comments. Plastic Beach is coming the next time I get a good.
The Gorillaz album?
Yes.
Are we getting a lot of comments from that?
I am getting people asking me about Plastic Beach and about the Flaming Lips because I still have the Robot album on my.
So
they're coming. They're next on my list. I feel like we're doing a lot of folk singer-songwriter, so I'm definitely going to switch that up with my wheel spins.
Yeah, actions. I should probably do that too.
Yeah, it's been a great singer-songwriter feeling for the past month or two, though. I've been really enjoying it, so we don't want to stay in one lane for too long, but them records be hitting. Ever since the Fleet Foxes self-titled record, it's like, that's the only thing I want to listen to.
That's so true. I just got that on vinyl yesterday.
Yeah, I need to grab that.
And it's cool because the self-titled comes with the EP, the one with Mike and Oz on it.
Oh,
interesting. So you get that. It's a two LP. One LP is the self-titled and the other one is the EP that you just get for free with it. And it's still like $30.
Yeah, I should grab that.
It's not bad. I haven't listened to the EP yet, but...
At Record Store Day coming up on 420, so...
Yo! Yeah, I would recommend it. It sounds very good.
Yes, sir.
But yeah, I just looked at my Goodwheel. The only thing that's not folk / singer-songwriter is Brockhampton's Ginger. Everything else.
Have Ginger in there.
Yeah, that's the only thing that isn't folk or singer-songwriter. Unless, I don't really know what Biba Doobie is. That's like... I don't know, like bedroom pop, like Claro type beat?
Yeah, I would say.
Yeah.
I need to listen to Sling again, too.
Slaps hard.
Every couple of times in my playlist, one will show up and I'll be like, ooh, Sling is so good.
Yeah, it just showed up. Like, a couple songs, like, showed up on one of my mixes or something. I was just, like, shuffling through music and, like, man, sounds so good. I love that album. Come back, Claro. I saw that she was having lunch with someone. Who was she having lunch with?
I think it was Billy.
It was Billy. Yeah. Which, that would be a good collab.
That would be a great collab.
Yeah.
We need, like, a Phoebe Bridgers, Lazy McAlpine, Billie Eilish, Claro, like, posse cut. And you can never tell who's singing at one time. Because they're all just the same person.
That's true. That would be... interesting, I guess.
I'm joking. There's little subtleties between all of them.
Of course. It was for the bit.
Yeah. I mean, Boy Genius works because they're different enough, but yeah. You could do like a genius and just do Phoebe Bridgers and Lizzie McAlpine, and then it's like you have to guess who's who every time.
I will say, on that Boy Genius record, sometimes I have a hard time discerning between Phoebe and Julian. Lucy has such a distinct voice.
Yeah.
But sometimes I'm like, is this the Julian verse or the Phoebe verse? I don't remember.
Yeah, I think I've listened to Julian long enough where I can, like, pick it up. But, yeah, sure. I think going into it without listening to a whole lot of Julian Baker, you can definitely get them mixed up. Or Phoebe, yeah.
So they kind of have similar ranges. Mm-hmm. Tones.
Although I do want to do Punisher on the channel eventually too, because
that's
some of those songs have been popping up too. And I'm like, oh, this record is still good.
I still have Stranger in the Alps on my list.
Yes, another sad record.
We'll do that. They had both. They had Punisher and Stranger in the Alps, and I'm like, I'm not gonna pull a me. I'm not gonna buy them without listening to it.
They will be available at pretty much any record store you can find.
That's true.
So, I think it's fine. When I really got into Phoebe in 2020, like, that was before she blew up, so finding her records was a lot harder.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I remember we went record shopping one time around there, and, like, you saw Better Oblivion Community Center, yes. And you're like, this is, like, the only time I've seen this ever in my whole life.
That would be, like, it was meant to be in, like, an Iowa record store. Like, that is the perfect setting for that record.
That's true. Which I have not listened to. I don't know.
It's interesting. Yeah. It's good. I don't think it's better than any of her solo stuff.
Okay.
But it's definitely mid-2000s, quirked up, kind of, I don't know, tongue-in-cheek folk almost.
Okay.
It's weird. I mean, you got the guy from Bright Eyes in it, so it's
a little quirked up. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the guy he did it with.
Conor Oberst.
Interesting. That's an interesting...
There's some bangers. It's not the best record, but I enjoy it.
All right. Well, we'll do Phoebe sometime.
Yeah.
I don't know. I do feel like we've been in the folk singer-songwriter bag for a little bit too long now.
Yeah.
Like, we do need to kind of...
It just makes the most sense right now. until I see Swans next month, and then I'm gonna like be a junkie for weird stuff again. So
yeah,
that's the clock's ticking.
That's true. So maybe we should get all of these in before then.
Yeah, I'm gonna get my brain chemistry altered and then just like want to do all weird stuff again.
I can see that. Man, I'm just looking at my list and like all of this is folk singer songwriter. I need to branch out a little bit. Find some stuff I want to listen to.
Yeah, we'll do a Bab Jab Wheel eventually. I think near the end of the year we might implement a viewer reaction marathon or something again. But
yeah,
I feel like we might be able to redo it a little bit and see who's still hanging with us and what they want to hear. Because I think our current wheel is like 100 albums long.
Yeah, so we need to refine it a bit.
Yeah, so y'all who are still rocking with us, you might have a lot more priority in what we listen to once we kick that into gear eventually.
Yeah.
Because there's still stuff on there from 3 years ago, which I don't think those, a lot of those are still relevant for us. But I mean, no. We still have stuff like Bury Me with Makeout Creek and stuff like that.
Oh,
we
definitely want to do that. So.
Yeah.
We still have not done The Smiths, The Queen Is Dead, which I think was our first one.
Yeah, I think so.
I don't know
if I have heard a Smiths record, though, in passing. And it's very good. It's just going to be very hard to praise him.
Morrissey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it is very good.
I don't know if I would.
I think it was the self-titled I heard. I don't remember.
Oh, I don't know. I just know The Queen Is Dead. That's all I know from now. Eventually.
Just true.
Someday.
5 years from now.
Yeah. If we're still alive.
Yeah.
But I guess that'll do it for this week's podcast. Tune in for our Lizzie McAlpine reaction coming out next week.
I know I will.
Watch our retrospective that we just posted. If you want to see updated thoughts and kind of a state of the union for the channel. I feel like that's kind of what the end of those videos turn into.
Yeah, definitely.
So if you're interested in where we're at.
A good one.
With everything. I think so. I think we had a lot of good conversation.
Yeah, we had a lot of updated thoughts in that one. Usually we don't have that much.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was a little worried about this one just because the last batch was so good. Like, consistent, like, banger after banger after banger. Like, oh, is this going to be as good? I think it was a good batch overall.
I agree.
Yeah. So, bye.